from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. It's the most common form of orthopedic arthroscopic surgery, a procedure to repair a torn meniscus. That's a piece of cartilage that cushions the knee joint. Some 700,000 Americans have the surgery each year, but a new study has called into question its value. In a new report carried in the New England Journal of Medicine, a Finnish study found that people who had a sham surgery in which no repair work was done fared just as well as those who had the actual procedure. Ahead on Forum, are we performing unnecessary knee surgeries? Would physical therapy work just as well? And what about other knee injuries and how they can best be treated? An hour all about knees, next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. If you're a runner, chances are you've experienced knee pain. Same if you play basketball, tennis, or any number of other active sports. But even if all you've done to your knees is ask them to ferry you about for a good number of years, knee pain is common. One frequent knee injury for athletes and non-athletes alike is a torn meniscus, and an arthroscopic procedure to treat it is the most common knee procedure there is. But this week, a new study published in the New England Journal of Medicine reported that people who had a fake version of the surgery did just as well as those who got the real deal. Does that mean that knee meniscus surgery, something some 700,000 Americans have done each year at a total cost of $4 billion, is unnecessary? And does this new finding call into question the care and repair of knee injuries in general? That's the topic we're going to explore this hour on Forum. Joining us to do that, Dr. Kevin Bozick, who is the William Murray Professor and Vice Chair of Orthopedic Surgery at the University of California, San Francisco. Dr. Bozick, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. Joining us as well is Dr. Jeffrey Halbrecht. He's the medical director at the Institute for Arthroscopy and Sports Medicine in San Francisco and was also the medical director for the Women's Pro Ski Tour for 10 years. Dr. Halbrecht, good morning as well.
Good morning.
Thanks both for joining us. So let's do a little bit of knee anatomy 101, if we might first, Dr. Bozick. The meniscus is sometimes described as sort of the shock absorber of the knee. Is that the right way to think about it? Tell us what exactly it is.
Sure. So the meniscus is a type of fibrocartilage, which is a type of cartilage that we distinguish from the cartilage on the ends of bone that we call hyaline cartilage. And the fibrocartilage is formed in the shape of a disc, and it can be thought of as a shock absorber that functions between the ends of the bone to prevent the ends of the bone from making contact during weight bearing.
And so, with this injury that happens so frequently, it's a tear in that cartilage.
So there are different types of tears. There are acute tears that can occur during an acute injury, such as the runner or the athlete that you alluded to. And the focus of this study was on degenerative tears, which occur probably from a number of traumatic episodes that occur over time, and is part of normal aging and degeneration of the knee that occurs over a period of time. So the study in question here, all of the patients had greater than 3 months of symptoms. So these were not acute injuries that occurred in response to, say, a traumatic episode or a sports injury.
So let's, Dr. Halbrecht, pick up the story from there. This is a study that took place in Finland, about 160 people, ages 35 to 65. And this is fascinating. They did surgeries, real surgeries on half of them, and sort of fake surgeries on the other. Describe exactly what they did and then what we learned from it.
Sure. This study was done in Finland. There were surgeries done at five different centers. And they took patients who had what they described as degenerative tears of the meniscus, which, again, are a very small subgroup of patients. And they took that group and tried to determine if doing surgery to trim out those degenerative tears was any better than doing a sham or fake surgery. And it was actually an elegantly designed study because they did make incisions and they did look around to diagnose in both knees, but they only trimmed the meniscus after an envelope was opened in the operating room to determine which group the patients would fall under.
And so we had – this is – I mean, it's fascinating that, that people would agree to participate in this study, right, because this has to be done with informed consent. So the patients knew that they might be getting the real deal and or might not. Is that right?
Yes, and that has to be taken into account in terms of understanding the efficacy of the study. But the one thing that they mentioned in the study is they did offer the patients the option to switch to a surgery option after 6 months if they weren't happy. So there was an out for those who had the sham surgery.
And the result was essentially no difference, right? If you had the fake surgery in which no repair work was done versus the real surgery in which the meniscus was trimmed up and smoothed out, you did equally well either way?
Well, in the scoring systems that they used for this study, they were not able to show a difference between the patients that had physical therapy and sham surgery versus trimming of the meniscus and the same physical therapy.
So what do we take from that? I mean, obviously, the most obvious conclusion is simply to say this surgery for this particular group of patients, people who've had just sort of general wear and tear as opposed to an acute sports injury, there's really no point in getting the surgery done. Dr. Halbrecht, is that what you would conclude?
Well, I think that one has to be careful when reading any medical studies because this is a very small subset of patients. So I think the conclusion could be made for patients in this age range that have a degenerative meniscus tear rather than an acute sports injury that surgery is not always indicated. I think that that's a fair conclusion.
Dr. Bosak, how do you read the results?
Well, I think there's a couple of important takeaway messages from this study. First of all, I think it's important to recognize that all of the patients in the study did have arthroscopic surgery. So all of them had a cannula placed in the knee and the knee was flushed. And so that may have a therapeutic effect in and of itself, the sham surgery as well as the patients in the intervention group. It seems from the results that debriding the meniscus itself did not result in any improvement in functional outcomes. And I think that's very important for us as orthopedic surgeons and for the public to understand because there are lots of surgical procedures that we have done for many, many years that we haven't always done a great job of defining the indications for the procedure. So in this case, that part of the surgery, the debriding of the meniscus, may not be effective in terms of improving functional outcomes that matter to patients. So that's very important. Another very important finding from this study is that patients in both the sham surgery group and the intervention group both improved significantly. So we know that the placebo effect, if you will, has a dramatic effect on patients, and that's important to realize. They were not comparing patients who had nothing done to them versus patients who had an intervention. Both patients had an intervention done, and that placebo effect alone we know is very powerful.
Yeah, let's spend a bit more time on that because that in itself is such a fascinating phenomenon, and this cuts across clinical trials that are done in medicine in various conditions, various diseases, both those that are drug-based as well as surgical. What do you make of that, Dr. Bosak, first, and then back to you, Dr. Halbrecht, about how powerful that is? What's going on, do you think?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to recognize how difficult it is to do a surgical randomized controlled trial. It's one thing to ask a patient to leave up to a coin flip whether or not they're going to take one pill versus a sugar pill. It's another thing to ask a patient to be randomized to a coin flip to tell us whether or not we're going to do surgery on you or not. And that's a very, very difficult thing to do, but also very important for science and for understanding the efficacy of these procedures. But we do know that a placebo effect is very powerful, and so that if a patient is given a pill or has a surgery or an injection or some other type of procedure, patients want to get better, and they want to please their doctor in this case who did the surgery, and so they certainly it has a powerful psychological effect on their well-being and overall function, and particularly when you're measuring subjective functional outcomes, as we are in this case, we're not measuring things using laboratory tests or other types of objective findings. We're asking the patient subjectively, do they feel better after the surgery?
And Dr. Halbrecht, I guess one thing that's often thought about with part of the explanation for the placebo effect may also be the people who choose to be in these sorts of trials are people who are kind of eager to get on with it and get better. Is that maybe part of what's going on as well?
Well, yes, absolutely. And I'd like to echo what Dr. Bozic said, is that basically when you're your state of mind and your motivation to improve is an extremely important part of the healing process. And when it comes to surgical randomization, like in this case, the reason that it took them 5 years to find 146 patients at five different hospitals could simply be the fact that the patients with more severe meniscal tears or symptoms weren't willing to participate in a study where they had a 50% chance of not having the treatment that they wanted. So it's important to understand what subgroup really was included in this study.
So let's talk more then about where this leaves you as people who do this surgery and who see lots of people with knee issues. One of the study's authors, Dr. Jarvinen, made this comment. He's from Helsinki University in Finland. He said, "Doctors have a bad tendency to confuse what they believe with what they know." And I remember talking to an orthopedic surgeon once about a family member about whether or not that family member should get a knee replacement. He said, "Well, you know, look, you're talking to a surgeon, and asking a surgeon if you should have surgery is a bit like asking a barber if you need a haircut." So I'm curious about how the two of you take this, Dr. Halbricht, and about whether or not it will modify some of what you may, how you may approach your own surgical practices.
Well, I do think that we all tend to be a little biased by our own expertise. So the benefit of studies like this is to constantly remind us as surgeons to take a really careful assessment of when we're recommending surgery. So there's a very positive outcome to studies like this, even, you know, for surgeons, where we tend to really focus on our own specialty. So I think there is an advantage to having studies like this published.
And Dr. Bozic, will you be less likely, maybe you already were, less likely to do this procedure now for the kind of wear and tear patients versus those who have had an acute tear because of a particular sports injury?
Well, I think, again, it's important to take each piece of medical evidence that we derive in context. And in this case, yes, I will use this information when discussing with patients the options available to them. I think we also have to take into consideration patients' preferences and values when making determinations or recommendations about treatment. So we take the medical evidence that exists, and each piece of medical evidence contributes to an existing body of evidence. And in this case, this is a very powerful study, a very well-done study in a very select group of patients. And we will use this information when discussing with patients whether or not this procedure would be effective for them. But again, it's important that we get this information out to patients so that they can incorporate this into their own decision-making, because many patients, as we've talked about earlier, have a preference for having something done rather than nothing done. And so this is one of those something dones that is often felt to be helpful, and we can now definitively say for this subgroup of patients, it may not be helpful in terms of achieving their ultimate goal of improving their function.
So who is it helpful for potentially? What kind of patient would benefit from this surgery?
Well, the meniscal surgery is helpful, at least we think, in patients who have acute injuries. So those were not studied in this study. But patients who, let's say, are athletic and injure themselves acutely, have acute onset of pain and swelling and tenderness isolated to that side of the joint, possibly an MRI corroborating those findings of an acute meniscal tear. We think in those patients, either repair or debridement of the meniscus may be helpful. It seems that from this study that patients in this age group, middle age, who have a degenerative condition with chronic symptoms, arthroscopic surgery and debridement of the meniscus may not be helpful.
You know, let me just offer this as by way of full disclosure. I had this procedure done. I injured a knee as I was training to run in a half marathon, had the surgery done after that race because I wanted to keep running and have been able to and have run in a couple of full marathons since then. So my conclusion is that it worked for me. But of course, it's really hard to know. You can't, Dr. Halbricht, sort of do a controlled experiment on yourself. Maybe I would have been just as well off not getting it done and by doing rehab and physical therapy, which I also did. That was the reason. I mean, how do you really know in the end what was the thing that helped or worked?
Well, I think the important take-home message for listeners is that if you have a sports injury or an acute sudden onset of symptoms from meniscus tear, this study doesn't apply to you. So patients that have a sudden acute tear were specifically excluded from this study and are still considered excellent candidates for arthroscopic surgery. And that tends to be athletes and patients that have mechanical symptoms. So that would be some sense of catching, locking, and a loose fragment of meniscus. Whereas patients with a stable, slow onset of a degenerative meniscus tear are the patients who were included here in the study that are not seemingly candidates for arthroscopic surgery, and honestly are the ones that most of us who do a lot of this kind of work were very hesitant to operate on anyway.
Let's open up our conversation and both to our listeners and sort of care of the knee in general, that joint that has to do so much for us. I was reading one article that said that, you know, with every step we take, we're putting 1.5 times your body weight on that joint. And if you run, you're actually putting 7 times your body weight on that joint. So let's talk some about care of the knee and ask our listeners to join us as well. You can join us at 866-733-6786 if you have a question or concern about caring for knees or if you're dealing with a particular problem at the moment, though we obviously can't offer specific advice to individual situations. We want to provide as much information as we can for knees in general. So, you know, Dr. Bozic, if are there, you know, most doctors, you sort of have this feeling like if you're a runner, you really just shouldn't go see your doctor because your doctor is going to tell you not to run. Do you feel that way? Is running, for starters, just not a good idea?
Well, so again, by way of full disclosure, I'm a former recovered runner who's had multiple arthroscopic procedures and now has degenerative arthritis in my knee at a relatively young age. But yes, I think as far as long-term protection of the joints, of the weight-bearing joints, I think non-impact type activities are the things that we favor, such as swimming, biking, hiking, other outdoor activities that do not involve impact, running, jumping, those types of sports are going to be more traumatic and cause more deterioration of the joints at a younger age.
And if you are a runner and determined to do so, no matter what you're saying, Dr. Bozic, what are your recommendations for people who want to continue to run?
Well, I think that, you know, having appropriate footwear and being analyzed for appropriate footwear is important. Making sure that you're doing some cross training to take care of the other muscles and strengthening the muscles of the legs at the same time as you're doing the running, and then running on appropriate surfaces and making sure that you're doing your training either with input from or supervision from a professional to make sure that you're not doing damage to your joints.
And when you say appropriate surfaces, meaning stay off of concrete, asphalt's better than concrete, trails or soft surfaces better than asphalt?
I think in general a softer surface is better. However, you have to take into account that many of those surfaces are uneven surfaces and then you're prone to turning an ankle or causing some other sort of injury as well. So I think all of those factors need to be taken into account.
Our phone lines are stacked up, so let's take some calls. William joins us first in Belvedere. William, go ahead, please.
Yes, thank you very much. I want to tell you I very much appreciate the humility of the guests, because one would think that they would, being surgeons, might say, oh, disregard it, everybody needs surgery. But that's not what they're saying at all, and I appreciate that very much. My question is, have there been any comparative studies in the acute meniscus tear situation which have compared surgery with physiotherapy?
William, thanks for the call. Dr. Halbrook, do you want to take that?
Well, interestingly, there really haven't been for acute meniscus tears. This study was an attempt in that direction to look at degenerative tears. I think the reason that study has not been done is that patients with acute meniscus tears are usually extremely symptomatic, and the data that we do have suggests that surgery is really the option for those. So it might be an ethical issue to suggest doing a randomized study to not treat those patients for acute very symptomatic tears.
Is it your feeling, Dr. Halbrecht, that that you know, it'd be one takeaway from this should not be surgery never works? I mean, that it's important to focus in on what the specific problem is and the specific surgery, and I guess part of this too is that physical therapy and rehab, it's not one or the other, that they can work in combination.
Yes, I think that's important. And for those who have the opportunity to read the entire article, the authors of this article themselves clearly state that this information does not apply to acute meniscal tears. So extrapolating to other situations would be inappropriate.
Why wouldn't rehab, knee strengthening, stretching, whatever it might be helpful or work in lieu of surgery for an acute tear?
Well, physical therapy is intended to help strengthen the legs, the muscles around the knee, to attempt to diminish swelling and improve range of motion. What it can't do is take a torn piece of cartilage tissue that's moving around in the knee and causing inflammation and swelling and make that better.
Yeah.
And the thing that the listeners should also know is that what this study is not saying that meniscus tears can heal themselves. So that's an important thing as well. So the fact that perhaps the pain improved, the meniscus tear is still there on an MRI, and even if one wanted to go back in and look surgically, that tear unfortunately does not have the ability to heal.
William, thanks so much for the call. Let's go to Joan next, who has an important and basic question about what the nature of the repair work actually is. Joan, go ahead.
Yes, one of the doctors mentioned repair of the meniscus in acute injury, and I was wondering whether this would act, how you would do this, and can you use, for example, a laser to heal the big tear in the acute injury, or prolotherapy, or stem cells, or maybe hyperbaric oxygen, or all combination, or what? How do you take a sports injury that's very acute and repair it? What do you do to the meniscus?
Dr. Bosick, why don't you take that? I know you have to leave us shortly, so take your best swing at that in about a minute and a half.
So we determine whether or not a meniscal tear is repairable based on the location of the tear, where it is in relation to the inner third or outer third of the meniscus, which has implications for the blood supply, as well as the type of tear, whether it's a linear tear or more of a flap tear, depending on the sort of the morphology of the tear, as well as the activity of the patient. And so an example is Derrick Rose, the professional basketball player from Chicago, recently had a meniscal injury, and the surgeon at the time of surgery made a decision to repair it, which means that he will now be kept off of his knee for 6 months and allow that meniscal repair time to heal itself, and that's done with various types of surgical techniques, different types of sutures, either arthroscopically or outside of the knee, going inside of the knee. But those types of repairs are very, again, it's dependent on the location, the type of tear, and the patient. And I would say the vast majority of tears are not amenable to repair. And so in those cases, we debride the tear or remove the torn part of the meniscus back to a more stable part of the meniscus to prevent that flapping around and damage to the ends of the bone that was referred to by Dr. Halbrecht.
So you're basically kind of smoothing and rounding as opposed to knitting it back together again. That's right? Yeah?
That's correct.
Okay. Dr. Bosick, thanks so much for being part of us. Sorry you have to leave us now, but really appreciate you being with us for the first part of our program. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, Dr. Jeffrey Halbrecht and Dr. Moshe Lewis will join us as well and take more of your questions. 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. I'm Dave Iverson. This is Forum on KQED. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, all about the knee, that much abused joint, what we can do to protect it and what we can do to heal from various injuries. Fascinating new study out this week published in the New England Journal of Medicine showed that people who had a sham form of surgery to repair a meniscal tear, the people who didn't have the surgery at all, did just as well as those who actually had the surgery for a particular group of patients, those who had an injured meniscus based on sort of overall wear and tear as opposed to an acute injury from a sports injury. But we want to spend the next half hour talking more about how we deal with knee injuries, not just meniscal tears, but how we can take better care of our knees overall. Dr. Jeffrey Halbrecht stays with us. He is the medical director at the Institute for Arthroscopy and Sports Medicine in San Francisco. And we're now joined as well by Dr. Moshe Lewis, who is a physical medicine and rehabilitation physician at the California Pacific Medical Center at the St. Luke's campus here in San Francisco. Dr. Lewis, thanks for joining us as well.
Sure. Thanks so much for having me.
So your focus is more on rehabilitation, and I want to ask you about people who have had a knee injury, whether they've had this sort of surgery or not, about what the key ingredient is to rehabilitation. Is it sort of a forever thing? I mean, usually you go see a physical therapist or you have some rehab work and you do it for a while, you're good and disciplined about it, and then you don't do it anymore. Once you've had some sort of knee trauma, is that something that you really need to keep working at in either a strengthening way or rehabilitative way on an ongoing basis?
Absolutely. I think you hit the answer on the head with the question. If you don't continue to use it, there is the possibility to lose it, is the adage, I guess. So you're right. The mechanics of the joint are such that those muscles need to work in a continuous fashion in order to help essentially distract the joint to some extent. You've got a gravity effect where the bones are over time coming together, even if there isn't a specific trauma. And so clearly the stronger that those muscles are, and like I said, even basic types of exercises, walking, bicycling, are excellent, elliptical as well.
What are some, just give me a couple of things that really anybody should do, whether they're an athlete or not. Is it stretching? Is it strengthening, doing squats? Is it losing weight? What are just some basic steps to generalize good knee health care?
Sure. Well, you've hit on a lot of the key elements. We believe if you stretch a joint just a little bit, then strengthening can really sort of take that next step. So the stretching routine doesn't need to be for hours and hours. It's a few minutes, especially maybe focusing on some of the muscles that tend to get tighter sooner, i.e. the hamstrings, for example, and then strengthening, really working on the quads, as well as core now we're finding also plays a key role in trying to help maintain muscle balance. So basic pedantic exercise, just even walking, and recommendations are 30 minutes, a couple of times a day, 10,000 steps. A lot of my patients are encouraged to put their little walking app on their cell phones. They all have them now, and it'll keep a track of you automatically. And then I love when patients do have issues that are going on, they've got some chronic pain and things like that, to really try to get them onto a bicycle or elliptical for 15 or 20 minutes, three times a week.
Do you tell people not to run? I'm still looking for a doctor. I'm hoping my doctor actually isn't listening, but I'm still looking for a doctor who would say, yeah, go ahead, run.
Sure. So it does. The mechanics of running are really complex. Obviously, they put a lot of stress and strain on the joint, and there's a lot of debate about the benefits of running up and down hills, especially when people are training a little bit more intensely for competition. So it's an exercise that we do like. We like patients to also cross-train and really strengthen their muscles and not just sort of try to do their first marathon or really big races without taking their knee into consideration, that it really needs to be warmed up and needs to be worked up to longer distances. Overall, for the young, it still remains a good exercise. As people get older, they really do have to take a little bit more care of their knees.
You were good on your answer until that last sentence. Dr. Moshe Lewis joining us, physical medicine and rehabilitation physician at California Pacific Medical Center, the St. Luke's campus here in San Francisco. Let's go back to our calls. Elizabeth joins us next, who's a physical therapist. Great to have you join us. Your perspective as someone who works on the rehab side of this.
Sure. I'm a physical therapist and orthopedic clinical specialist. I know Dr. Lewis and Halbrecht and Dr. Bozek, worked with all of them. And I think there's a number of things that you need to consider. First of all, we see a lot of those degenerative joints that have tears, and we try to convince the patient not to have the surgery because we think that we can keep them well enough, long enough, that they don't need to have that done, and they can go on their life. Most of them don't do heavy exercise. They don't do squats, but we can keep them well with being sure that if they have good alignment, we keep the muscles balanced. Both the lateral hamstring is often, excuse me, the lateral quad is often missed, and it needs to be stretched out. Then the IT band gets extremely tight in a lot of people, so the patella, the kneecap, tracks laterally. So we want to have good balance between the muscles. We also know that when you rehab too fast, insurance companies had forced people for a long time to just get them out the door as fast as we could. We created synovitis. And then synovitis causes arthritis, and eventually those people ended up with a total knee replacement. So, you know, we've been fighting with insurance to say, hey, look, let us treat the patient maybe not as many times a week, but over a longer period of time. That way we can really get them to understand their home program, to understand the exercise, to strengthen appropriately for what that joint can take.
And Elizabeth, let me just interject to make sure I understood the first part of you, what you said about that you try to convince patients not to have surgery. Are you talking about those with kind of general, the degenerative wear and tear? Or are you also convincing people who have had an acute tear based on a sports injury not to have the surgery?
Absolutely not, because I myself have had three knee surgeries. And my first was a traumatic ski injury. And when I had the physical, I actually tried physical therapy, being a physical therapist myself. I tried for about 4 months, and it was horrible. And so I went and had surgery. I went back to windsurfing, running, skiing, everything, but with a brace when I skied. And it was fine for 15 years until the one day I didn't wear a brace.
Yeah. Elizabeth, if you would, can you stay with us for a while? Might be nice to have your perspective on this as we continue to take our calls. Let me read a couple of comments coming in. This one is from Tony, who writes in, I had knee surgery nearly a year ago for torn meniscus. I have regained 70% of my previous knee function. The injury was and surgery were described to me as if I was going to get better, I needed the procedure. To hear that modern medicine is playing craps in the operating room to try to figure out whether the science is working is outrageous. Dr. Helberg, why don't you comment on that? Because we need to be clear about this, and I don't think Tony is exactly getting what went on, because this was a study with informed consent. The patients knew they were participating in a study that would determine whether or not this procedure worked. Half would get the real surgery, half would get the fake surgery. So it's not accurate to call this craps, but fill that in if you would, Dr. Halbrecht.
Well, as I mentioned a little bit early in the hour, that there are some ethical issues when it comes to basically not providing a procedure or service to patients before you know whether it's going to be helpful or not. So the informed consent is extremely important and essential for a study like this. It's often hard to do studies like this in the United States, where patients are very informed and in some ways demanding about what kind of treatment they want, and this study was done in Finland. But even there, they definitely had informed consent. And the other important factor is they did offer those patients, once again, the opportunity that if they weren't happy, they could switch back into the surgery group after 6 months. And I believe five patients actually did wind up having surgery who were in the physical therapy group ultimately.
Let's go to our next call. Sharif in Morgan Hill joins us. Sharif, go ahead.
Good morning. Yes, what I'd like to find out is, going back to the study, if they did follow the group after they were informed of whether they had sham surgery or not, and if there were any relapses, and also if the relapses correlated with the sham surgery.
Can you take that, Dr. Lewis?
Yes. So that's a really good question. The challenges are always trying to see, this is really, and I can also see what Dr. Halbeck says, but correlating studies that we've seen before. It's not actually completely new. In the Mosley study, we saw something very similar. I think the key point that he brought up was that at least patients were able to go back into the surgery arm, and they weren't allowed to essentially languish. The idea of sham, I think, is, you know, very, very complex, and some people question it. But we have known that if you take all comers for this type of surgery for quite some time, that some patients simply will not need it, essentially, because they essentially don't have enough criteria to have any more benefit than they would from therapy.
Dr. Halbrecht, anything you want to add to that?
Well, just one other factor. It's hard to take one study out of context. There was another study done earlier this year, also in New England Journal, by Katz, that looked at patients with a little bit more arthritis and meniscus tears, and they had a similar kind of setup where they had patients in a surgery arm versus a physical therapy arm. And although 70-some-odd percent of the patients seemed to do well with therapy, 30% of the patients did switch back into the surgery arm even in that study. So following these patients over a longer period of time, some are definitely going to switch back into the surgery group.
And I just want to chime in 1 second, too, though, because I think Dr. Hallbrecht raises a good point about pain. We now are in a crossroads as to what is the best way to deal with that. And while, and I think all the people have hinted at that, while we can continue to use medications or injections or talk therapy, acupuncture, physical therapy, there does come a point in time where when someone is suffering, it's appropriate to see what more is going on and not just continue on conservative treatment ad infinitum.
Dr. Moshe Lewis, again from the California Pacific Medical Center, joining us along with Dr. Jeffrey Hallbrecht. And for a while, we were also joined by Elizabeth, the physical therapist, but we've lost her. So, Elizabeth, if you're out there somewhere and can rejoin us, we'd like to have your expertise included in our program as well. Let's go to Bill next in San Francisco. Bill.
Yeah, hi. First of all, thank you very much for this program. It's an excellent way to help folks save money in the medical world. I had a slightly torn meniscus diagnosed by an eminent San Francisco surgeon, sports medicine surgeon. And due to some cardiac issues, I was unable to have surgery, which he recommended. I got a second opinion, and I had a second opinion by one of Dr. Bosick's colleagues at UCSF, and the UCSF surgeon recommended an ACE bandage. I applied that bandage for a few months and continued walking 2 to 3 miles a day, and I'm in very good shape. I'm kind of a easygoing athlete. And the bottom line is I went back to that eminent surgeon after a year. He did some more diagnostic work and said that no further surgery or no surgery was required. So I'd like everyone to know that the surgeons should consider this ACE bandage process. Is there something to that? It worked for me.
Dr. Hallbrecht?
Well, there's nothing like a good ACE bandage and some ice to treat a lot of orthopedic injuries, so time-honored treatments. But I think the caller is most likely had the kind of tear that was described in this study. And I think the message from his experience and from the study is that as orthopedic surgeons, we do need to stratify patients. And I feel like in our practice, we've always done that, but perhaps in a larger message to general community orthopedic surgeons that not to pull the trigger on surgery so quickly, especially for these degenerative type tears.
Bill, thanks for the call. Kate in San Rafael. Kate.
Yes, I have just been diagnosed recently with a Baker's cyst due to a tear, small tear in the meniscus, and it's fairly significant, and I'm scheduled for surgery on New Year's Eve, and I want to know how this study relates to that kind of condition.
Yeah, I just want to give our doctors a bit of an out here because it's very hard, and I'm sure they don't want to provide specific advice without knowing more about your situation, but maybe we can at least round this out some in terms of the connection, either Dr. Hallbrecht or Dr. Lewis, whoever feels best able to take this, about the connection between the Baker's cysts and
sure.
And torn meniscus.
Well, I can start and then let Dr. Hallbrecht, who also I've had the pleasure of working with, chime in. We typically don't tend to drain Baker's cysts, and obviously they're an accumulation of the fluid behind the knee, essentially, because given typically chronic inflammation, it doesn't have much other location to go to. But as was pointed out, it's hard without fully knowing your case how to offer a second opinion. And so I'll defer to Dr. Hallbrecht on that part.
Well, just again, for the listeners, a Baker's cyst is basically a bag of fluid that forms in the back of the knee, and it's a very nonspecific finding. Anything that causes inflammation in the knee can lead to accumulation of fluid, which then leaks into the back of the knee and collects there and can become quite painful. So surgery can be effective. I actually do sometimes aspirate or drain those cysts, especially to give people some short-term benefit. So if you're wanting to enjoy your new year, that could be an option for you and delay any other treatment. But conservative non-surgical treatments for Baker's cyst do exist, and those would be injections of cortisone, draining the cyst, and perhaps modifying some of your sports activities.
Kate, thanks for the call. Good luck. I think that this also raises the kind of second opinion question and the value of it. When I was considering getting the meniscus surgery done, I saw a sports medicine guy, but then I also had the images, the MRI images, sent to my doc, who then advised me to go forward. That's a useful kind of thing to do, when you say, Dr. Lewis, I mean, to sort of get a collective wisdom on this?
Sure, I love it. I think that many times you can get differing opinions. It doesn't necessarily mean that somebody's, you know, absolutely wrong. Sometimes the conservative approach, definitely the study supports, can seize the day. And I think the challenge that at least my patients face is just the logistics behind that, the time to get another appointment and get through it and the insurance piece of it. And so I encourage it, though, and certainly want patients to often feel that, as Dr. Harlock was stating too, there's not usually such a rush that the couple of weeks or even three or so that may take to get through two different offices is such that the patient shouldn't seek out that second opinion. But patience is necessary, because usually it can't be done in a matter of days. It can be very difficult, even with good insurance, to get into two offices, get all the imaging reviewed by both practitioners, and get both opinions done.
Kate, thanks. Thanks for the call. Robert is next. Robert, go ahead, please. Robert?
I think one of the most exciting things I've heard about meniscus repair is the use of stem cells to regrow the meniscus. And I know that I've heard that there have been a few successful surgeries doing this. I know it's very, very early in that process, but I'd be interested to hear what you know about the status of that.
Yeah, Robert, thanks. Dr. Halbricht?
Sure, I'll tackle that one. So, well, stem cells are certainly an exciting new area of biological treatments for orthopedic injuries, and that's a giant new field that's just on the horizon. As far as data that supports use of stem cells to treat meniscus tears, it was really one good study that was performed by a company called Regenex using stem cell injections into the knee to treat meniscal tears. Unfortunately, that study did not show efficacy for stem cells treating meniscus tears. So at this point, there's really no science to support that as an option for this type of injury.
Robert, thanks for the call. Couple of emails I want to read. Greg writes, I wonder if one had the detailed data from the huge number of patients who are from imaging or whatever, whether one could do correlative studies that would tell us exactly which specific injuries would have a high probability of having benefit from the surgery. In other words, are we now essentially running blinds? Interesting question, Dr. Halbricht. I mean, assume all tears are not created equal, right? So can you tell from imaging this one is a good candidate, this one isn't?
Well, the MRI is certainly the best imaging device that we have for making decisions, but it has to be taken into context along with the clinical findings and the mechanism of injury and how the patients were injured. So you can tell on an MRI scan if a tear looks more degenerative versus more acute, but you also have to take into account the patient's story. If they hurt themselves playing basketball, it's quite different than if it's someone who's relatively sedentary who had the slow onset of pain over 3 to 6 months.
Debbie writes in, I'm a small size 65-year-old woman in good health. My question is the use of an inversion table too much stress or weight on the knee joint? I'm not sure what that is, but I'm betting Dr. Lewis does.
Yes, and I have patients that do use that, so it's an insightful question. And really, at least I've seen that it is most beneficial in patients that have lumbar spine or spine pathology, just in terms of the level of distraction that can be created there. So essentially, it creates traction. You get on this table, and you can get all degrees of tilt and essentially help almost create an anti-gravity situation.
And is it, what about for someone who's 65, active, is it a good idea, bad idea for what
it's
it
not,
does to the
right.
knee?
I like that patients have had some introduction to it through a physical therapist. And again, I find, at least in my practice, that it's more beneficial for spine than specifically for knee.
Here's a question about relates to skiing. In 1982, this individual tore a meniscus following some skiing. And it goes on to say, I followed instructions for intensive anti-inflammatory treatment with icing provided by fellow mountain athletes. After a month, the knee still felt unstable, so I went to see a knee specialist who evaluated the tear as 8 on a scale of 10. But recommended physical therapy. I jumped on the bike, in the pool. Within 2 months, I was back to skiing, and I've never had any pain since. Is it possible that that Vail orthopedic doctor relied on physical therapy because they recognized that athletics could do the work necessary to stabilize the injury? Dr. Halberg, you've done a lot of work with skiers. Does that make sense to you? And tell us also what this means, 8 on a scale of 10.
Well, we often evaluate pain on a 10-point scale, so that's simply a way of judging subjective pain. It's very hard to know specifically what injury this person actually sustained with skiing, so saying that you had a ski injury could mean many things. The common pathway for a lot of pain is simply that the knee is swollen and inflamed, whatever the possible cause of that. If you bang your knee and have a little bruise, it can get swollen and painful, and if you tear your meniscus, it can get swollen and painful. So the certainly, without knowing if there was any structural damage to the knee, the correct recommendation would certainly be trying to control inflammation with medication, ice, rest, maybe an ACE bandage, and to rehab the knee to get it stronger again. So that sounds like the right recommendation, as long as there wasn't any major structural damage.
We've got Hannah on the line next from Corte Madera. Hannah, go ahead.
Hi. I'm wondering whether the study that you addressed at the beginning of the program, the surgical study, considered the effect of needling on those patients who had the sham surgery and whether that was a similar beneficial effect.
Dr. Halberg?
Well, I'm not quite sure what the caller means by needling, but they did make a distinct effort to have the patients feel like they were having the same procedure. So they pretended to do arthroscopic treatments by pressing arthroscopic instruments and putting them into the knee. I think it would be very hard to know if that in itself has a benefit. I think earlier Dr. Bozic mentioned that the fact that the arthroscope was even put into the knee and that fluid
right.
was washed around in the knee could have itself had a beneficial effect.
Yeah, it's so interesting to think about what provides effect. Our friend Elizabeth has rejoined us, our physical therapist Elizabeth. Sorry we lost you there for a while, but we want to bring you back just in the remaining minutes. If you've been tracking our conversation on this topic on the air, I'm just wondering, Elizabeth, whether you have further thoughts on the kinds of things that people can do, especially since, you know, this is the time of New Year's resolutions. People want to do better physically in the year ahead. Your thoughts on sort of knee health in general as we begin the new year?
Sure. I think it's really important if they get properly evaluated for their alignment. And there's some people who run who have severely knocked knees, and it's probably not the exercise of choice. So we look at a person's alignment and make some recommendations with maybe that person should be better off on a bike. We look at their shoes. Don't wear worn-out shoes, for one thing. And most people need shoes that have a stable counter instead of being really soft. People sometimes assume that a soft shoe is really great, but often it causes a lot of instability in the ankle. They should have a balance between their hamstrings, their quads, their IT band. They should strengthen and stretch and do aerobic exercise. I think when they do squats, they need to be careful that they don't do a really deep squat, but that they whatever squat they do, they keep their knee in alignment with their second toe so that they, again, don't go knock knee, because that's a really bad strain on the medial aspect of the knee.
You know, you raised something that I'd like to our other docs to chime in just as we come to a conclusion about this. And this is just the idea of evaluation. Dr. Halberg, this makes so much sense, really, that you ought to have someone look at you, you know, look at you walk, look at your feet, look at you run or whatever. You really just shouldn't go into a doctor's office and lie down, right?
Yes, looking at someone in an active functional position should be part of every orthopedic evaluation. And certainly I'm a major advocate for physical therapy. We have physical therapists working even in our office. So I do think that seeing someone in a functional situation is the most useful.
And last final tips. Go ahead, Dr. Albrecht, and then I'll get to Dr. Lewis on keeping your knee healthy in 2014.
Well, I guess my message here at the end of this program would be that since we're entering into ski season, assuming we get some snow, that patients remember a few things, including trying to do some preseason conditioning and strengthening, because if you're not ready for the slopes, you could get injured. And to try to avoid that last run of the day when you're tired and your muscles aren't with the way as strong as they need to be, and just go in for that après ski instead of taking that last run.
And Dr. Lewis.
Sure. I second a lot of those emotions today. Specifically, I like the elliptical. I think that's a great machine to help cross-train, and also bicycle, so not only skiers, but just people who have knee issues in general. They don't have to put on high levels of resistance, but definitely continuing to focus on strengthening as well as stretching some of the muscles we discussed today, hamstrings and quads, as well as not neglecting core is critical. And then Elizabeth mentioned the importance of the ITB as well.
And Elizabeth, just a last a quick recommendation from you, please. Are you there, Elizabeth? Yeah,
yes.
Go ahead.
Yes. Don't forget to strengthen your glutes. Very important for hip stability. So.
Always end to end on a recommendation to strengthen your glutes. Right. Thanks all very much, Elizabeth, as well as Dr. Halbrecht, Dr. Lewis, and earlier Dr. Kevin Bozek. Thanks for your advice and information about keeping our knees well and when surgery might be a good option and when not. Useful information. Thanks all very much. Forum is produced by Tina Lorberg and Katie Springer, along with Irene Noguchi and Judy Campbell. Jim Bennett is our engineer today. Dan Zoll is our senior editor. Amanda Supai, our engagement producer. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegas Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.